So the next paper is titled Simultaneous Considered Harmful, and the talk will be given by David Reed from SAP Research.
Okay, usual caveat that this is not does not represent a position of SAP regarding products or anything. It's just, it is related to what I'm doing as research there, but not directly. Think of this as a position paper, but some of these folks have, up before me have proposed specific answers. I'm actually trying to reformulate the question. And the reason for that is I've been doing parallel computing for, it feels like most of my computing career. In fact, I started out in high school working at MIT on simulating sea states in a towing tank model using an analog computer, one of those things where you turn knobs and connect inductors and capacitors and so forth. So that's innately parallel. And I've been thinking about time for a long time. And so this is not saying that parallelism is considered harmful. It's important to recognize that I'm saying the word simultaneous is harmful. And we'll see why in a second. I'm thinking about what time is, and actually I really like this quote from John Wheeler, who's a famous physicist, that time is what keeps everything from happening at once, and space is what keeps everything from happening to me. And what I want you to take, besides the fact that it's funny, what you should take away from that is that time is about modularity. And it might take a few seconds for that to sink in. But in some sense, time is nature's way of partitioning problems. it's one of nature's ways. Space is the other one. And along with that, actually, modern physics, for example, has recognized that the way we think about time is actually probably not the way nature modularizes itself, and that maybe there's really not exactly a real thing called time at all. And that comes close to what I'm trying to talk about. So to set this up, what's been bugging me for a long time is that if the world is embarrassingly parallel, and you look, I'm a great computing machine. I don't have a clock. I don't have a distributed, set of timers in me that coordinate everything. But I work pretty well, and most physics doesn't have clocks. Why do we invoke time as a fundamental notion whenever we talk about parallel computing? So I'm going to take the advice of Alan Kay and take a change in perspective, which ought to give us 80 IQ points, I hope. And really, the point of this talk is to suggest that it's worth reading the paper, which is a lot more dense and probably makes more sense because I worked on the wording better, and really think about what you're doing. And so perhaps the most interesting part is the next slide, which is a set of calls to action. And it's a set of calls to action to computing as a whole. I feel like now that I'm an old man, I can actually pretend to know what to do, and that's why I had the obnoxious title that refers to Dijkstra's, fight against the go-to. And I think there's some good reasons to fight against the notion of simultaneous. So I'm going to talk about some principles because they're principles that I think as computing we all agree with, and they lend support to why we should do that. And in particular, if you look back in computing history, which isn't that long, it kind of goes back to Turing and von Neumann in some sense, or maybe back to Babbage. You can think of computing as a series of choices about how to think about computing, and some of them were really good choices. When I was a kid, it wasn't clear whether computers should be fundamentally decimal or binary, and fortunately we chose binary, which had the side effect that people think a bit is the smallest amount of information, but we won't go there. if we'd chosen decimal, we'd think a dit or whatever, a 10-state thing was the smallest possible amount of information. But because of that history, we've acquired a bunch of roots, which are kind of things that we know that ain't so. And around parallelism, it's my theory that, in fact, the accumulation of these barnacles or warts is why people think parallel computing is hard. And my radical theory is that parallel computing is easier than sequential computing. And I think in my own head I've come to agree with that conclusion. The really hard thing about computing is sequentializing stuff, or sequencing things that are inherently not sequenced. So you actually have to make choices that you don't need to make. So you do early binding and so forth. If you're going to add two numbers together and another two numbers together, why does it matter that you write down in one order than the other? It's just baggage. So there's three categories of traps that I want to talk about in the slides, and I talk about a bit more deeply in the paper. And they're traps that we should get out of. One trap is a lot of things I've encountered in my career in computing, which is careless design of primitives. Primitives that worked really well in a limited context, but we've somehow made general purpose ideas. Just to name one so you can have it in mind, semaphores is one of those. It was really good when we had when we were multiplexing a single instruction stream processor, and they're really bad for everything else. So the idea to deal with these things is to find better primitives and start using those and encourage people to deprecate the old primitives. It's a natural thing. But some of these primitives are thought to be so important that we teach them as if they're given by God in undergraduate courses, and maybe we should be a little more skeptical if we want to deal with parallelism. Second is that around parallelism, we gave up all thought about what would make a good modular decomposition of a system. Modular decomposition of a particular program is one thing, but I build, in my day job, I worry about building enterprise systems. They're very large. They involve many components. They need to be managed. They need to be upgraded, and so forth. Modularity is about that problem. Modularity is not about making the most efficient code. It's about making code that, lasts and can be evolved and can be recovered when something fails and all that kind of stuff. And it turns out that the modularity that is really good, for example, object-oriented programming as implemented in various languages and so forth, for sequential programs, actually is really awful for parallelism, because we added parallelism on the side. And I like, for example, the previous talk, and I'm not picking on it, it's a great set of concepts, but the reason he had to do that talk was to patch onto a sequential design something that would make parallelism a little easier. My point there is, why don't we think about what modularity in parallel world is? And then finally, we do virtualization. Virtualization has become really important. It's different than modular problem solving. It's basically constructing abstract machines that are much easier to deal with and evolve than a particular random piece of hardware with all its warts. So the Intel architecture is a virtual machine already, because it's implemented by many schemes. Sometimes some of the things are done in hardware, some are done in microcode, some are emulated, all that stuff. That's a virtual machine. But we don't we don't think about how to virtualize a whole system end to end, or all the attributes of a virtual machine that, for example, is enterprise-wide. Instead, we virtualize memory, we virtualize, the CPU, we virtualize networks with VLANs, and one has nothing to do with the other, yet they're all executing in parallel. So that's kind of one set of, that's the framing, and if you just remember that framing, that's good. But the other thing is, there's a bunch of calls to action implicit in that framing, and this is really why, mostly I'm here to learn from you guys what's active in the field, because I've been out of parallelism for a while. But what I'd like to do is contribute back a perspective of things I think are really important to do from an old guy who's been around for a long time. So the first one, and maybe you all buy this already, but it certainly isn't true in industry, parallel ought to be the norm. It's not the radical exception that's for the geeks in the HPC community or whatever. Intel has been wonderful in kind of getting that ball rolling, but they only got it rolling in one chip, right, really fundamentally. And we've been designing, you know, multi-user systems. You know, the whole e-commerce web thing is a parallel system, and yet we don't know how to think about it. So, because we still want to think about it as a sequential system, and it's just wrong to do that. Second, and this is kind of the reason for the title, is I think the idea that you can achieve simultaneity at a distance, simultaneous access, action as a, at a distance, is the bad habit that's kind of at the basis of all these problems. It may not be explicitly stated, but a lot of our programming constructs, a lot of our computing constructs and so forth have kind of in the back of your mind or even in the front, something that happens simultaneously across the entire system or a really substantial part of it, you know. And it's a bad habit because it doesn't scale. It's also a bad habit because the boundaries of the system are not closed anymore. You know, today it may be bounded, but tomorrow it's going to have more parts. So to achieve simultaneous action at a distance that includes the whole system, you know, it's a fuzzy concept. It makes no sense. So to solve that, we need to commit to eliminating the constructs that have operational semantics that either implicitly or explicitly say we achieve simultaneous action at a distance. Those are very tempting things to have because they're really powerful hammers. They're so powerful that, you know, you're likely to kill yourself with it. And better to use something that actually models reality. Here's a deep one. For a lot of the theory community and a lot of people who try to design correct programs, their definition of correctness is equivalent serializable execution. Now, I don't know about you, but the world of physics and the world of biology does not have an equivalent serializable execution, right? We're the only field that defines correctness or a model as being serializable as the fundamental truth, right? And it's certainly not true. I mean, it's a useful tool occasionally, but it's not fundamental. It's a good reasoning tool for certain environments. I don't want to throw it away, but question it whenever somebody says, you know, we need to be serializable. And this has killed the database management system community, this particular assertion, because it's actually grew up with them, and it's a really bad idea. So, as I said, good modularity principles should never invoke the term simultaneous. And sometimes you can invoke it by saying total ordering, you can invoke it by a bunch of synonyms, but you probably shouldn't even think about that. And finally, we need to fix programmer thinking. This is probably the hardest thing. It's a paradigm shift. Paradigm shifts are hard. I'm going to suggest that it may take a generation, but it would be a really good thing to start. That's the call to action. And finally, reject Amdahl's law. I mean, it's true, but the reason it's true is empirical because it's not that the problems are sequential and have large bulks of sequential. It's because our programs are sequential. You know, so if you get a sequential program that does, say, a Fourier transform, and it's a really great program, I guarantee you there's all kinds of optimizations in there that are specifically done because you've got a sequential execution engine, right? So discovering parallelism in something that's written with so much explicit attention to sequentiality is almost impossible. You know, the idea of parallelization is not taking a program that works, it's taking the function that you want and thinking about it. And it's actually really easy, you know, I'm an electrical engineer, it's really easy to think about Fourier transforms as parallel first, and then you only have the problem of if you only have a serial machine, then it might be hard to make it fast. But if all machines are parallel, you won't even have to bother with that. So here are some of the important issues around this problem. One is that, in my opinion, the important things about computing systems is that they evolve over time. It's almost never about optimality with a particular set of hardware and a particular set. Unfortunately, the old HPC culture, which I think is kind of fading away, was a tuned to bare silicon culture, you know, for the most part, and evolution was buying a new machine and programming all the old algorithms on this new machine. That's not the way the rest of the world works, and I think it's gone away. Second, the idea that systems are modular, I go back to Parnas, who wrote kind of the most essential paper on modularity. He said modularity is relative. It's relative to the task, right? And if you're going to develop the principles of modularity, what good modularity is not something that allows you to partition the task among programmers. It's modularity that basically makes the system more modifiable. And he came up with the information hiding principle. When we put things in parallel, all of a sudden, all kinds of information leaks like crazy. So those are bad. The particular, any modular system design that leaks information like crazy because of parallelism is not a good modular system. So we need to invent a better one, and I'll talk about that. There's a tendency among programmers, this is more a programmer bug, to think of module composition, you know, because what you do with modules is to put them together to make a bigger module. It's tended to be conceived of as either order of execution or equivalent to an order of execution. You know, and in the case of parallel composition, you could sort of say, well, both of these things happen after that and before that, but it's always thought of as a time base. And in fact, modular composition has almost never has anything to do with time. The one case is when you're actually touching I/O timing, where humans are involved or physical machines are. That's that separation, which I have, you may not like Haskell, but I think Haskell has got a brilliant, you know, approach to that, which is, you know, creating this thing called the I/O monad and so forth. But even if you're not interested in functional programming, the idea that dealing with the timing related to I/O, which is sort of outside the system stuff, should be in any way related to the timing inside the system is a real problem for parallelism, and I don't think it's necessary. And I'll talk about that. You know, so a classic example that shows up in is write ordering to memory. There's all kinds of debates about processor write ordering, right? You know, what a write is a message. It's a broadcast message to all the other, you know, parts of the system. And the question is, you know, what is the order of two unrelated writes when they received by other computations? If you just start off by saying, well, actually, we should program as if it doesn't matter because they are unrelated writes, that would be a good thing. But we can talk more about that. And then the idea, you know, what the final issue is that I really want to focus on is that, as a historical thing, is that because we've defined parallelism in terms of a faster version of a serial program, and that, you know, we talk about program-to-program equivalence, the serializability, as opposed to, you know, whether it solves the problem as stated, whatever that problem is, whether it's a problem of time or whatever, we end up with an over-constrained problem. And whether it's, you know, the way we make processors better is by doing, you know, complicated things like superscalar processors that have, you know, scoreboards and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, in some sense, if we hadn't written the code that said this is the order of execution, then we wouldn't have to worry about whether it was, you know, flexible. We could have written the code in, say, a data flow language that talked about, you know, functional units. It's a small matter of coding, you know, how do you code, you know, code the stuff, the program into bits. The way we do compilation and interpretation, which is, you know, virtualization, involves resource binding rules. You know, the binding of an abstract resource to whatever execution unit, or whether it's memory or a ALU or whatever, that where the rules are over constrained. You know, there's no particular reason why I have to, you know, use the ALU in a particular sequence with respect to, say, the memory bus. You know, those constraints are perhaps inherited from the hardware, but not necessarily. So let me get one level deeper. This is the point from the title. There's a notion in physics called unspeakable. it's maybe the philosophy of physics, but basically the point is it's something that is meaningless or should not be spoken about because it only confuses the matter. A lot of quantum theory is about defining certain things to be unspeakable that are intuitive concepts for us. Relativity basically says there is no simultaneity. And Lamport and I and a few other people back in the mid-70s said, you know, it's actually true that all we really care about is causal ordering. In a computing system. And so why don't we just build systems based on causal ordering rather than program counter ordering or whatever it is. But the point is deeper than that. The world itself is not, you know, real physics and real biology and so forth doesn't have, you know, an absolute time base. It has causal ordering. You know, it's local communications, you know, and causality propagates through the system. So if you don't need a consistent total ordering of events to define the correctness of the system, why do you build it? Well, the reason Lamport and I built these kind of virtual clock things was because we wanted to provide a crutch for people who thought sequentially and who needed proof that there was a serial execution. But it wasn't because it actually made life easier, it just made the hardware execution a little bit more flexible. The problem with total orderings is that one way or another, when you have to actually implement something that provides a total ordering, even if it's not always enforcing simultaneity, it ultimately requires some kind of simultaneous access at a distance. And the first problem with that is that the diameter of the system can be very large, and it can be unknown at design time if you're designing just a module of a much larger system. So every system I know of that tries to loosen time basically says, within this scope, you know, one machine or one local area network or whatever, we're going to define that everything obeys this rule so we can achieve total ordering, right? Well, why did we need to do that in the first place? You know, there's no particular reason. I list in the paper a bunch of things and you can think of these. Diving into the primitive area, which is separate from simultaneity, we have a whole lot of problematic primitives, and these are just things we should stamp out. I mentioned one in a comment earlier, the memory management calls that in operating systems that imply that something happens everywhere. MProtect, if you don't know it, I think most of us who design systems know that the Linux MProtect call is the way to bring systems to a halt, right? It's basically, you change the access on a page from read to write or write to read, everything in the system shuts down as you do TLB shootdowns, right? So it's a great test of the performance of TLB shootdowns, but it's a user-exposed primitive, and if you want to do a denial of service, that's the primitive to use. The semaphores at a higher level have the same problem because they try to bundle in too many different issues. In particular, they try to bundle in mutual exclusion, so you mutex, you P and then you V at the end. And it's the P and the V that sort of, you know, have costs that scale with the size of the system. The parts in between, obviously, you're probably not contending for very much. But there's a zillion things. You know, the Linux open, you know, the Unix open system call throws in something that, you know, basically it's MProtect and a few other features that basically requires cross-system coordination. You know, and you know, occasionally you can cache that or optimistically do it and so forth. But it's really, you know, you're opening a file. It's no big deal. You're finding where it is on the disk. You know, there's lots of ways to define a primitive that doesn't have, you know, global stall semantics. Compare and swap instructions are called lockless programming. Well, there's a lock in there. It's a lock on the memory bus that actually has to propagate through the messy protocol, if nothing else, across all the coherent parts of the system. And that's not exactly a scalable thing. And you can write almost any program without that instruction. The ones that are hard are the ones that were written sequentially, and now you're trying to parallelize them, and you have to preserve the sequential stuff. So there are also primitives that work really well and because they only imply causality. Fork and join, I invented some synchronization primitives that are slightly nicer than semaphores called event counts and sequencers. There are certain kinds of LIFO and FIFO queues that can be very causally ordered. In fact, you know, a FIFO queue can have the property that you know, since it's relatively uncertain what order the what order the stuff was put in, you know, you don't actually have to guarantee very, very tight bounds on ordering at the receiver, you know, of the data arriving at the receiver. And near Shavit at MIT has pointed that out. You know, and there's a zillion things. So replace, basically, you know, if we could just make a list of all the Linux primitives, for example, that imply, you know, this global thing, we should stamp them out and replace them with better stuff. I don't know how culturally to do that, but it doesn't make life harder. And in fact, there's a paper about to come out at another conference by Franz Kaschek and a couple of his students about the fact that operating systems whose APIs are defined in terms of commutative primitives scale much better than those that don't. A lot of these primitives are non-commutative, and you know, it's a good example of that. Finally, I'm going to come to the, you know, say one thing about modularity, which is that information hiding ought to be extended when you're doing atomic actions or idempotent things, so that if they happen, you know, without causal ordering, there's no chance of exposing information. So you talk about inside an atomic action, it doesn't leak information to other things that are accessing quote unquote shared variables. You know, for example, they just shouldn't be shared. And you might be able to achieve them by the kind of rules that were talked about in the previous talk. And idempotency is a really important idea in parallel fault-tolerant computing, because basically you can do stuff over and over again in different places and the results are the same, so you don't have to worry about synchronizing them. So that's, I'll just say virtualization has a whole set of these issues as well. I've talked about that and should be fixed. So with that, I'll wind up because I don't want to run too far over time. But the point was to start a conversation, and we can talk here or at the paper session or poster session or whatever.
So, a few clarification questions at this stage. Yes.
Oh, on the simultaneity, the thing that seems to really be problematic to you is trying to make it simultaneous across the distance.
Yeah.
Are you therefore okay with things that we use, concurrence blocking or whatever, if they enforce locality?
I think they're much less problematic if they're really constrained in space. You know, and so on local variables, you know, it's not a big deal, and in some sense, that's not you know, from an engineering point of view, that's not that important. It's when they leak out. You know, the idea of action at a distance gets applied to larger and larger distances. So
if they're using discipline, they might be okay, but if they're using a discipline manager, then that's important.
The culture said only use compare and swap for things that you can prove are local. You know, it's probably okay.
That's a
yeah, it could be within a chip or something that it's got a measurable bounded cost. Yeah.
Yeah. So, what do you think about the one thing that really makes it difficult to build, like, say, a database server or other kind of general purpose infrastructure is that you often don't control the communication patterns of the whatever's sitting on top of you, and that really causes trouble. Like, if you have two different users that are actually seriously communicating back and forth, a lot of these tricks kind of go out the window.
Partly I think of that as a problem of accountability. Like, if you're going to write a program that doesn't work, whose responsibility is that? You know, it's kind of like if you basically do something whose result is undefined and you know it, you know, you should try to prevent that, right? So that's their responsibility. Obviously, you'd like to help people not have it easy enough not to end up falling into those traps. And so exporting APIs and tools that make it easy to understand what's going on is good. And perhaps the other thing is my call that we should teach programmers parallel first. Because actually, if you start off with parallelism and think of sequentiality as for the advanced programmer who's got resource constraints that are really tight, you know, so they only has one execution unit, and you know, then it probably creates a set of users who understand how not to do that. Okay.
Yeah, I had one question. In your the way you look at space and time, and there was a comment made about locality.
Yeah.
So how should one think of locality at that level of abstraction? You know, where you have sort of causal orderings, but you have space and time. Clearly it's important, and it's getting increasingly important in future systems for energy reasons and memory hierarchy reasons and so on.
Right. Well, as I say, you know, to me, and this may be, you know, a really radical extreme, you know, space and time are just a reflection of nature's modularity, and we named them that, you know, so the, you know, so what time may be, you know, in physics may be a little bit more subtle than we normally, as kids grow up, thinking about. But the notion of locality, which means sort of the probability of interaction, you know, clearly if you separate things in time, the probability of having an effect is much smaller, separating them in space. And there's a, you know, so I think that's a design principle like, you know, virtual memory locality, which is that, you know, you should decouple things that are far apart, and if you want to couple things, you should put them closer together in time or space. Yeah.
Well, the inverse of the question I asked before, if you had something that was had unbounded non-locality, but you could prove that it was happening infrequently enough, would that be something to be okay with, or is there some implication of the unbounded non-locality that makes that bad regardless?
In most practical systems that are like multi-user or multi, you know, multiplexed, even if it's infrequent, if it's costly, you know, if it's disruptive, like, you know, the system-wide garbage collection, even if it happens only once every fortnight, when it happens, it's really a pain. So, you know, it's if you can push it into a place where nobody cares, that may not be such an issue.
The key thing is the cost of the operation, but also the disruption to other parts of the system.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the whole argument I'm making is disruption, but maybe disruption at the design time, disruption at you know, runtime, you know, it's all those different levels are disrupted by lack of modularity and invoking a concept, which is this simultaneous action at a distance, that I would argue is almost never needed, right? But, I mean, that's an article of faith, almost never needed. You know, if you can find an example where you need it, then I'll I'll back off from that.
Okay. So maybe this is a question for the panel, but you said multiple times that, you know, and I've heard this before, that I know it's easier to express, you know, that if you do it right, it would be easier to express a computation in parallel than it is to express sequentially. But in the end, reasoning is sequential, and the notation of writing a program is sequential, right? So, and sure, you know, my point is that it seems to me that when you say that we're trying to impose order for something that don't have order, it might just be an artifact of how we reason about things. Right, so I just don't know how you can get rid of that. And I had a question: whether you read recipes in parallel or in sequential, or sequentially,
well,
when you're cooking something?
Actually, I do a lot of parallel cooking, and you know, I think about it as parallel because I want to get all done at the same time.
But recipe has sequential steps, right? I mean, it's laid out.
Well, there's some sequentiality, and the sequential steps are the ones that are causal, right? So,
right.
So I'm not saying that causality goes away. You have to do certain things where the result matters to the next step, you know. That's, but it take, you know, I hate to invoke this, but my favorite programming language these days, which I don't use a lot, but I use it because it helps me think, is Haskell. Right now, you get away from all the notation about it. Basically, Haskell can both do, it can do two things for you. One is that it can be evaluated in any order, and it has the same result. You know, so the underlying order is not that, except for the application of functions to results. So it's a good notation for this. And the other thing about it is that it's introspective. That is, if you learn how to use it well, you can actually write the primitives that specify additional ordering constraints in the language itself by defining functors and so forth. You know, where it matters, it's at least within the same domain, and it's simple. You know, so I don't think teaching Haskell to fourth and fifth graders is the right way to start because there's a lot of deep math in there. But you know, those of us who have had experience trying to teach parallel stuff to people who don't know how to program yet, you know, ranging from Alan Kay with his eToy system, or I just met somebody this morning, Chris, who's taught a fourth and fifth grade class on parallel programming. To you know, it's not actually been hard. You know that, so that's not a proof, but.
Okay, to be continued in the panel discussion. So let's thank David again.